Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Over the last three decades, many of us have become much more familiar with the term autism, even if we don't have a clear understanding of its meaning. My guest today contends that one reason there's been an increase in our awareness of autism is since the 1990 passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we've simply recognized it more. The ADA ensures that persons on the autism spectrum are guaranteed accommodation and education, and as such, many parents have come forward to have children diagnosed. Contrary to bad information spread in mass media, autism is not caused by any vaccine, nor by bad parenting. Our best understanding is that autism is a multifactorial set of conditions which causes disruptions in information and sensory processing that can, but not always, lead to stereotypic behavioral patterns. Eric Garcia is openly on the autism spectrum. Despite difficulties with learning and communication, he wound up attending the University of North Carolina and has become a political journalist, writing for a number of publications and covering Congress along his professional journey. Garcia is currently senior Washington correspondent for The Independent. He has a new book called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. It's an informative and personal look at the policies and tribulations that people with autism undergo, and Garcia seeks to educate and encourage understanding that most people with autism don't seek to be cured, but rather better understood and accommodated. Eric Garcia, senior Washington correspondent for The Independent and author of the new memoir and policy analysis, We're Not Broken, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Eric Garcia, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by having you define in your own words what autism is to you.
Sure. So in my opinion, autism is a disability. I want to be clear that I think autism is a disability. And it is a disability that I think that affects social interactions, social cues, and communication. And I think that it defines how you therefore interact with the rest of the world around you.
Yeah. And so it appears, based on the literature, for example, just reading about it in public media, we think of the story maybe of Temple Grandin, who you allude to at one point in the book, that there are more people now diagnosed with forms of autism possibly than ever before. And you give a couple of reasons for that. What are those?
That's right. So it's important to remember that autism didn't have its own separate diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders until 1980. So what that means is that up until then, it was seen as a symptom of schizophrenia. And what that meant was that for a long time, it was seen as a very, very narrowly defined condition. It was seen for a long time. People only thought that it affected, one in 10,000 kids. And you hear that, you hear a lot of anti-vaxxers say, oh, back in the day, it was one in 10,000 kids, and then there's been a spike in it. The reason why is because up until then, it didn't get its own diagnosis until 1980 in the third edition of the DSM. And then after that, you had a pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified included in the DSM. Then in 1994, you got Asperger syndrome after Lorna Wing translated the works of Hans Asperger, who was doing research about autism in Nazi-occupied Vienna. And then in 2013, you got the kind of umbrella diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. All the while, you saw public policy moving more toward trying to better understand autism. So in 1990, Congress passes the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a reauthorization of the Education for Handicapped Children Act. And what it said specifically in the House of Representatives report on legislation, it said that, quote, autism has suffered from an historically inaccurate identification with mental illness, and that including autism in IDEA was, quote, meant to establish autism definitively as a developmental disability and not as a form of mental illness. And what that did was that it included autism as one of the disabilities that therefore children had a right to access a free, appropriate public education. And what did that mean? It meant that schools now had to report how many autistic kids they were serving. So throughout the 1990s, with this combination, with a broadened autism diagnostic criteria combined with a government mandate to provide autistic kids with an education, you saw an increase in the number of autistic kids, an increase in the tracking of autistic kids. And what happened was in the 1990s and the 2000s, I think a lot of people saw those numbers and they thought, oh, epidemic. When really it was just we were getting better at diagnosing.
Yeah, and you're very clear that you consider yourself a beneficiary of the Americans with Disabilities Act because it provided educational benefits specifically directly for you that in essence helped launch your successful career as a journalist, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was born in 1990, the year that the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act passed. So what that meant is I was entitled to certain services at school, and what it meant was that I was entitled to certain accommodations when I work and when I travel and when I and anywhere else that I kind of navigate. They were not, and I'm explicit about this in my book, they were not the windfall that they should have been, but they were the beginning of something and they were the starting point of something. And it's indicative of what public policy can do, that even when you get not even half a loaf, you can make tremendous progress for plenty of people. And imagine what could be done if we had fully recognized and realized the promises of the ADA and the IDEA.
So I would say one of the major themes of your book, and I love the book, I should say, and it really taught me a ton. And I would say I probably suffered from this mindset being, you know, quite ignorant about autism. First of all, it's highly prevalent. So there's a high likelihood that all of us, if we don't have somebody in our family with somebody who has autism, or at least on the spectrum of autism, we're certainly going to know somebody. And those people may not be outed. They may not want to reveal that fact, but in fact, we may know them. But most importantly, I think, is the thesis of your book is really that in spite of good intentions, many people in the medical profession or parents are looking for cures for autism. And your argument is essentially, and that of many, what I guess the term of art is neuroatypical people would say, it can't be cured or we're not looking for cures, but we're looking for the system to accommodate to us. And so that's really one of the major differences, and something I took away from the book is that we need to be, you know, more flexible as a society, and that, you know, large bureaucracies and, you know, sort of systems that lack a little bit of humanity and adjustability don't always work for everybody. And it's a good lesson for all of us.
That's absolutely correct. I think that what I realized, and one thing that changed when I was writing, is I used to think that, you know, a cure might be good for some autistic people who have higher support needs, but, you know, we should accept and welcome autistic people who have lower support needs. What I've come to realize is that the search for a cure really doesn't serve anyone, regardless of their support need level. And one thing that you realize is that oftentimes attempts to, quote unquote, cure autism have often had or almost always have deleterious effects. And most of the time, autistic people aren't even consulted when it comes to whether we should have a cure. And what that does is that leads to some pretty negative things. You know, for example, there is a place in Canton, Massachusetts called the Judge Rottenberg Center that administers shock therapy to autistic people. Plenty of parents try to find different diets or, you know, try things like chelation therapy or even try to feed their kids bleach to, quote unquote, cure them. And the thing that I kind of argue is that your kid is your kid and you should love your kid for who they are. You should love the person, the autistic person in your life for who they are, and not try to shape or reshape or mold them in a way that would fundamentally alter who they are. And I think a lot of people misunderstand me when I say that I think that we should accept autism and think that I think that autism is all lovely. It isn't. Autism is a disability, and it also comes with impairments. But we should focus on fixing those impairments and focus on ameliorating those things that do legitimately impair people, while at the same time making the world more adaptable and accessible for autistic people.
You know, I'm struck by the comparison to accommodations we've made for people with mobility challenges or, say, pregnant moms. And I think about curb cuts for, you know, locomotion devices, wheelchairs, and how those, you know, were especially designed to help people in wheelchairs, but in fact, we all benefit from them. Bicyclists benefit from them. You know, this is like society is, as a whole is often better for these accommodations, or, you know, wider hallways in apartment buildings, or, you know, grab bars in bathrooms and toilets and those things. So these types of things really benefit all of us in the long run.
Absolutely. In the same way, I think that, you know, making workplaces more accessible for autistic people so that, you know, when autistic people, you know, listen to their employers, you know, they're given clear and concise instructions and they don't have to kind of navigate the in between the lines. That's something that benefits all people, neurotypical or autistic. Making sure that the lights aren't too bright may be the difference between a meltdown or not having a meltdown for an autistic person. But they can also, but that can also just be a generally positive thing for all neurotype people. And at the same time, I think that making sure that nobody I know really likes open office spaces, but for some reason, for some godforsaken reason, we've defaulted to that. But everybody having their own kind of private space where they can work can always be a good can always be a good thing.
That's really funny about open spaces, especially now with the pandemic. It seems like that's pretty counterproductive. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Eric Garcia, who's a journalist. He's now a senior Washington correspondent at The Independent. He's author of the excellent new book called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. And Eric, one of the other things you taught me in this book is that autistic people in general, and I guess it's not all autistic people, really don't like the label or distinction about high versus low functioning. And I think we as a society have this idea that certain autistic people are quote unquote high functioning, and probably, you know, you've probably been called that in the past, or and that others are quote unquote low functioning and probably have a difficulty getting a job or holding down a job. Why is this labeling problematic?
The labeling is problematic, or I would just argue inaccurate, because it is based on what neurotypical people see rather than what autistic people themselves require. So, for example, a lot of people might think, and I profile her in the book, a woman by the name of Julia Bascom might be seen as high functioning because she's the executive director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. She has advised presidential candidates. But at the same time, she has a support person when she goes home. And it is because she has a support person that she can do all those things. And in the same way, I think plenty of people might see someone like another person who I profile, a guy by the name of Hari Srinivasan, as low functioning because he has limited speaking capacity with his mouth and speaking verbally. But at the same time, once he was given the chance and once he was given a communication device, he was able to be successful. And he's now a student at Berkeley, at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's now on the federal government's advisory committee for autism, the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. And so I'm not a fan of the terms high functioning or low functioning because they don't really describe autistic people. They describe how the rest of the world perceives them. And if you call someone low functioning, what you're essentially doing is you're setting the bar criminally low for them and saying, well, they're low functioning, and therefore you almost give the rationale for we shouldn't spend too much time on them because there's not going to be much hope for them. And in the same token, we'll say sometimes, this person is high functioning, so therefore we don't need to spend that much money or resources on them because they don't really need that much. But that really flattens the experience of being autistic.
You know, and one of the other, I think, notions that's out there is that people with autism, even though, as you teach in your book, it's a very wide spectrum, and as we sort of just discussed, is that people with autism, and this is such a huge generalization, it sounds almost comical to say it at this point, but they enjoy repetitive jobs that people with autism, like, they like to do kind of stock repetitive tasks. You kind of blow that myth apart.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say that autistic people need to, because like I'm stimming literally, which is, you know, self-stimulatory behavior for all the people who don't understand it, and that might be something that benefits me to help me, you know, adjust to my environment. But that doesn't mean that I want to do the same job my whole life. And I think that there's this idea that if you hire an autistic person, and I think this is the rationale behind a lot of these autism hiring initiatives, that if you hire an autistic person, that they will be happy to do the same job for the duration of the career. And that's just not true. Autistic people want the same things. They want to be able to move up in the company the same as anybody else. They want to be able to grow in their careers. They want to be respected. And even if they don't necessarily have the prospect of moving that high up into their careers, they want to at least be paid with commensurate with their experience. And it is a mistake to just, once again, it is a mistake to assume that they want to do the same thing their whole lives. But a lot of times I think employers think that, oh, great, we're going to have somebody who's going to stick with us forever, and they're going to be happy to do the same thing for the duration of their career, rather than asking them or rather than just considering what they're doing. And in the same token, I think this is the rationale behind paying some autistic people and some autistic people, disabled people as a whole, below minimum wage and putting them in sheltered workshops and saying, well, they're going to do the same thing over and over again, and they're not going to mind if you pay them below minimum wage labor, when in truth, everybody deserves to be paid a fair wage.
Right. I guess I sort of believe that rhetoric until I read it in your book, where it's so pandering and insulting, the idea that we would pay anybody a sub-minimum wage.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't want to attribute malice to anybody, but I think that for a long time that was seen as the compassionate thing, because we had a very limited understanding of disability and intellectual disability to be certain, and developmental disabilities to be certain as well. But I think that we project a lot of assumptions onto autistic and disabled people with disabilities and people with intellectual disabilities, but we rarely ask them, and I think, or we rarely get feedback from them. But for whatever reason, whether it's a lot of these hiring initiatives in tech companies or sheltered workshops, we tend to make a lot of assumptions without asking the input of autistic people.
Yeah, and I think that's possibly the biggest take home from your book, is that if we're going to make policies, we ought to include those about whom we are making policies. They should be at the table. They should be teaching us. We should be learning from them.
Right. And I think that a lot of people, whenever I talk about this thing, a lot of parents will say, oh, well, it's easy to just ask you because you are, quote unquote, high functioning. And we've already discussed why I don't like that term. But, you know, and they say, but my kid can't speak. Well, for better or for worse, I think that, you know, I have a lot more in common with your kid than you think. A lot of, quote unquote, high functioning, or as I call them, lower support need autistic people, have more in common with your kid than you think. And B, your kid does have ways to communicate. It's up to you to find the best way to listen to them. And I think that as a result, and then when you find a way to communicate for them as somebody who can speak or somebody who is neurotypical, your job is to advocate for their needs rather than your needs. And in the same way, I think that you should listen to autistic people who can't speak but who have other means of communication, as well as autistic people who may have lower support needs.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and I'm talking today with Eric Garcia, who is a journalist. He's senior Washington correspondent at The Independent. He's also written for numerous other publications and author of the excellent new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. And Eric, one of the things I learned about you personally is you have a deep passion for reporting. You do for reporting, but also for politics. You are, I guess you could describe yourself as a political animal. You love political campaigns. You've covered many of them. And you educate yourself and go and ask, it sounds like, very probing questions that don't always please the political subjects. In the book, you mention a time where you were covering Senator Cory Booker prior to him being involved in the Democratic primary in 2020.
Prior to, yeah.
Yeah. He made a statement that revealed some ignorance. Can you recapitulate that and sort of, you know, what he said and what he compared?
Yeah, so this had to be in 2017. He was giving the speech about the Federal Reserve, and he talked about corporate America and corporate greed, and he talked about how pollution had led to higher cancer rates and asthma rates and autism rates, you know, but he's a smart guy. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a Stanford grad. And then on top of that, you know, you can disagree or agree with him, but he's just a really nice person, love him or hate him. And so that told me, it was like, oh, even if you're a person with good intentions, I don't deny he was trying to prove a point. And he was trying to say the right thing. But it showed me that even incredibly intelligent people like Senator Booker can get things wrong about autism. And that was partially why I wanted to write this book, was because I felt that there had been so much misinformation about autism that even people with good intentions who want to do good were getting bad information about autism. The same thing I should add was, you know, in 2008, Barack Obama and John McCain both kind of spread misinformation about vaccines and autism. And neither of them are particularly bad people. I interned for Barack Obama when I was younger. And then I had the pleasure of interviewing John McCain a few times when he was a senator as a reporter. Both of them are incredibly good people. Both of them are patriotic Americans. But even they got things wrong. So that told me as a reporter that we get a lot wrong about autism. And if we get things wrong about autism, that must mean we are creating some pretty bad policy around autism.
You brought up that reference that those, politicians of two parties, front runners in the 2008 election mentioned about autism and the association, much later proven to be the pseudo-association. That is to say, there's no association between vaccines and autism.
Right.
But I wanted to hear your take on that.
Yeah, so it's important to remember that just as a lot of people associate, when they think of vaccines and autism, they think of like Jenny McCarthy, and they think of Jim Carrey, and they think of a lot of celebrities, and they think of Hollywood. And then later on, of course, that goes to Donald Trump. But this is also happening on the political level. Andrew Wakefield was invited to, Andrew Wakefield, who was the doctor who initially created who introduced the kind of correlation between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and autism, testified before Congress in 2000. I think he testified again. I forget how many times he testified. And then he eventually found an audience with Donald Trump. And this misinformation was permeating the body politic, not unlike a virus. And it created this kind of paranoia and this kind of skepticism about vaccines that we kind of see today. I mean, I've kind of said this a few times that the current coronavirus vaccine paranoia is to the Lord of the Rings what the autism vaccine paranoia is to the Hobbit. You wouldn't have that kind of skepticism and doubt about vaccines had it not been for that panic in the late 1990s and the 2000s.
I should go on to say that Dr. Wakefield had his license revoked. He's been censured.
Yes.
His paper was retracted by The Lancet. I mean, he's been thoroughly discredited for the disinformation that he spread, just to make that abundantly clear to our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But what's fascinating is that now he is going on QAnon podcasts. And as I said, he had an audience with the president in 2016 and with future President Donald Trump. Damage was done.
So let's pivot for a minute and talk about healthcare. For people with autism, sometimes it can be tricky to get healthcare coverage because some people with autism have need for things like special medical devices or caregivers, as you point out. And
yeah.
So Medicaid becomes a crucial policy tool for helping people with autism. But you go on to talk a lot about the misconceptions in the medical community about autism. If there was a message you'd like to give to our medical community about autism, what would it be?
Stop trying to cure autism and start listening to what autistic people say they need to be treated. A lot of times doctors make these misperceptions about that there needs to, that, you know, the thing that needs to be cured is the autism rather than the actual medical conditions that they had. So most of the time, there are these misconceptions or there's this misguided attempt to cure the autism rather than the actual medical conditions. And then on top of that, because a lot of doctors don't familiarize themselves with autism, a lot of times they will misread social cues. Or, you know, I profile this one woman in my book by the name of Lydia Wayman. And because she was told to, like, you know, keep a positive attitude, her doctors thought that she was too happy or too positive when she was talking about autism. Or when she was talking about her, not about autism, but talking about her illnesses, because she was trying to follow social cues, or they thought that she was being too specific because she was told to be explicit about what her exact health needs were. On top of that, I think that there's a lot of ignorance about the coinciding conditions that a lot of autistic people have. Epilepsy is probably the biggest killer of autistic people with intellectual disabilities. But we haven't done a lot of research into that, and we haven't done a lot of research into the fact that heart disease and suicide are the two biggest killers of autistic people without intellectual disabilities.
Not enough research, you're saying, into heart disease?
Yeah, no, there hasn't been enough research, no.
One thing that you did discover in your research is that it seems like in the autism community, there does seem to be a high number of people who identify as LGBTQ or trans in the community, and I wasn't sure if that was mostly anecdotal or that was based on some data. That it seems like people with autism are more, perhaps more vocal about it, or because they're living with a disability, or maybe more comfortable being more out or open?
Yeah. So there was a study in autism research in 2018 that surveyed 309 autistic people and 310 neurotypicals. They found that while 30.9% of typically developing people reported being non-heterosexual, 69.7% of autistic people reported being non-heterosexual with high rates of bisexuality, homosexuality, and asexuality. There are also plenty of transgender autistic people. And one of the things that I wondered I was kind of surprised by that, because I hadn't really seen that representation in the media. And then the thing that I did was when I started going to events, I often joke that, like, as a cisgender heterosexual male, I was often in the minority as an autistic person when I would go to these conventions. But one of the things that I was talking with one person by the name of Charlie Garcia Spiegel, who's an incredible young man who's transgender, who is autistic, he basically said that because a lot of autistic people see gender norms as kind of a social norm, like everything else, that it allows them to, because they're autistic, they question those norms, and they kind of realize that some of them might be, you know, just socially constructed, and they might not necessarily fit into them.
That's interesting. Interesting. I wanted to finish by asking you about music, because you have, it seems like, have a deep passion for music, and you talk about how when you're working or trying to meet a journalistic deadline, that you like to play loud, sometimes, I guess, heavy metal or pounding music. But the chapters of your book are all named either for songs, I guess, you love, or for musical phrases. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, before I ever got into journalism, I wanted to be a musician. My dad's a musician. My stepdad's a musician. You know, my dad plays the drums and my stepdad played bass. So music was always just a big part of my life. And, you know, I grew up listening to the music that they both loved. You know, my dad loves bands like AC/DC and Rush and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. And then my stepdad loves bands like Bruce Springsteen, and he loves Little Richard, and he loved The Animals. And so that really shaped me. And then later on, I got into like heavy metal music, and I got into hip hop music, and I got into punk rock music. And so to this day, that music, the kind of language of my life is written in rock and roll music and heavy metal music and later R&B music and blues and jazz and punk rock and thrash metal and later hip hop music and gangster rap.
Well, the name of the book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. It's by my guest today, Eric Garcia, who's senior Washington correspondent at The Independent. Eric Garcia, congratulations on your book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Garcia currently serves as senior Washington correspondent for The Independent. His new book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.